we have to be very, very careful. What we're talking is not so much democracy, we're talking organised hypocrisy. Hard facts.
A productive dialogue is not only good for the United States and good for Russia, but it is good for the world. The disagreements between our two countries are well known, and President Putin and I discussed them at length today. But if we're going to solve many of the problems facing our world, then we're going to have to find ways to cooperate in pursuit of shared interests. Too often in both recent past and long ago, we have seen the consequences when diplomacy is left on the table.
You have been watching perhaps one of the most disgraceful performances by an American president at a summit in front of a Russian leader, certainly that I've ever seen.
Well, I'm shaking my head like everyone else you've spoken to in the last 30 minutes or so, because I've been here for 30 years. I came to Washington in the final months of the Reagan administration, and I have never seen an American president simply surrender to the leader of Russia. You should call this the Surrender Summit.
The madness that erupted in the West over the sight of a U.S. president having the temerity to treat his Russian counterpart, Vladimir Putin, as an equal rather than an underling, a colonial vassal who knows his place, was even more pronounced and intense than anyone could possibly have expected. The reaction from mainstream media pundits and their political bag carriers in Washington in particular, in response to the Helsinki summit, can only be described as unhinged. Traitor, they cried. A surrender summit, they declaimed, thus revealing that for such people, peace and stability is tantamount to disaster, while conflict and chaos is nirvana. And in light of the collective madness that spewed out from every mainstream media platform in response to Helsinki, I am convinced that Trump, a president I personally loathe as a product of white supremacy and white nationalism, is toast. Washington neocons and liberals will simply not accept anything less. But this is even more loathsome. For as egregious as Donald Trump undoubtedly is, both as a president and as a man, his political and ideological adversaries are even more so. The most important and universally anticipated summit between a US president and Russian leader at any time in history, including, I would argue, the Cold War when the Soviet Union was still extant, ended up being dominated by the ongoing Mueller investigation into alleged Russian interference in the 2016 US presidential election. This, by way of a reminder, is an investigation yet to produce or throw up one scintilla of concrete evidence in support of these allegations. Meanwhile, en passant, in response to Trump's assertion made during his joint press conference with Putin that he does not accept the conclusions of the US intelligence community that Russian interference did take place, well, I can do no better than refer you to the tweet that was posted by Scottish comedian Frankie Boyle, who opined, and I quote, "Trump, in his madness, being able to point out the truth that the US can't trust its own intelligence agencies seems to me positively Shakespearean." So yes, Trump's opponents, led by Clintonite liberals whose sense of entitlement is consistent not with democracy but ownership, are obsessed with the objective of ejecting him from office as soon as is humanly possible. And given the tenor of some of the rhetoric that ensued in response to Helsinki, it would seem by any means necessary. So not only am I left convinced that liberal stroke neocon America is bent on ejecting Trump from the White House before he serves out a full term, I am also left convinced that it is bent on conflict with Russia, come what may. Because in truth, what we are dealing with is a pathological attachment to the supposed verities of US hegemony and exceptionalism. References to Munich in 1938, to Neville Chamberlain's Peace in Our Time moment, have been bandied around like confetti in response to the Helsinki summit, thus confirming that we are dealing with people who, per French statesman Talleyrand, have forgotten nothing and learned nothing. The Helsinki summit was not a rerun of Munich in 1938. However, the reaction to it certainly evinced the character of 1914, when war fever had Europe in its grasp, leading inexorably to an abyss into which millions of predominantly working-class men were pushed, not in the cause of freedom, liberty, or democracy, but in service to national exceptionalism and imperial domination. This is the animal we are dealing with today, a beast of insatiable and unquenchable appetite that will brook nothing less than full spectrum dominance. Thus, no, the takeaway from the Helsinki summit is not peace in our time. It is Russia, delenda est. Russia must be destroyed. I'm John White, and this is Hard Facts. Well, one man who certainly understands the nature of the beast to which I just referred is George Zamuli. George is a journalist, author, whose most recent book is Bombs for Peace, NATO's Humanitarian War on Yugoslavia. George, welcome.
Hello, John. How are you?
Well, I'm very concerned, I have to tell you, with the intensity of the reaction to the Helsinki summit. Now, you heard my analysis of the summit and the reaction. What's yours?
Well, I generally agree with you. It was quite an extraordinary event. I don't think there's ever been any meeting between the President of the United States and the leader of the Soviet Union, or subsequently Russia, in which the entire military, media, political class was so absolutely, resolutely hostile to this meeting. And much of which was ready to denounce the President of the United States as a traitor for meeting him. And, you know, even within his own administration, many people were aghast at Trump's meeting with Putin. This is something that is extraordinary, that there's a president. It's like there's only one man in America who seems to be determined to improve relations with Russia, and that is Trump. And there's no supporters anywhere else. I mean, all previous cases of détente, generally, the media class would be supportive of the president. Would be think, good, this is a, you know, we may be able to get something done. Here, there is just a complete hysterical meltdown at the idea that you meet the leader of Russia, the leader of a nuclear superpower, and do anything other than, you know, harangue him and push him around and maybe punch him in the face. I mean, it's complete insanity.
George, as it happens, I am rereading George Orwell's classic novel 1984, and I have to tell you, there is a lot of similarities between Orwell's prediction of a dystopia in the future and what we are seeing today with this war fever. And I'm minded of the quote from Orwell's novel when he said, "The enemy of the moment always represented absolute evil, and it followed that any past or future agreement with him was impossible." And this was redolent. This reaction on social media and in the within the commentariat to the Helsinki summit reminds me of Orwell's formulation. There is something pathological about this, George, that demands an even deeper analysis than we give it on a political level.
Yeah, it really is. And this artificially generated hatred is now accompanies every military adventure on the part of the West. I mean, we had in the early 90s Saddam Hussein. George H.W. Bush said he was worse than Hitler. Then we kind of forgot a little bit about Saddam Hussein during the 90s, and suddenly Radovan Karadzic, the Bosnian leader, and then Slobodan Milosevic, the Serbian leader, they were the embodiment of evil. They were the new Hitlers. Then he was back to Saddam Hussein again. He was the Hitler who had to be destroyed. Then we had this with Gaddafi. Then we had it with Assad. Now the new hate figure is Putin. But this time it's a little more dangerous, because all the other adversaries were relatively weak and couldn't do very much in opposition to the United States and NATO and all the usual crowd. Russia's a very serious power. So this is a very dangerous path on which the Western elites have embarked on. Demonizing Russia and preparing for war with Russia is a really insane course. But that's the course we seem to be on.
Now, it's become apparent to me that many former Trotskyists are leading the charge in this anti-Russia narrative. I've felt for some time, George, that Trotskyism's logical conclusion is, in fact, neoconservatism. From permanent revolution to permanent war, from revolution from below to hegemony from above. I mean, there really does seem to be a through line here.
I think that that Trotskyist movement of this permanent war and a refusal to accept, you know, the realities for what they are, and to move in a kind of an intelligent path is a totally destructive policy. And when you think of, the early days of the Soviet Union, I mean, there was a reason why Trotsky was eliminated from power at very early on, simply because his policies was just not viable. I mean, that, if the Soviet Union was to
adventurism. Survive, it was pure adventurism, wasn't it?
Exactly. There was no way the Soviet Union could survive other than by consolidating its power and proceeding cautiously. And so that is why the Stalinist policy prevailed and eventually succeeded in World War II. The Trotsky policy would have led the Soviet Union to disaster.
Very well put, and I agree completely and in every particular with that. Where has this narrative taken us, George? The Helsinki summit, as most people, maybe people lacking the requisite political depth, might have thought that this would be a progressive event that would go some way to fomenting better relations between the US and Russia. It's clear to me that regardless of what came out in that joint press conference, if Trump had lambasted Putin in front of the world's press, had accused him of interference, had committed America to doing whatever it could to stem what they consider to be the tide of Russian expansionism and all this propaganda, it would not have been good enough for Trump's adversaries. They believe Trump is a cuckoo in the nest of a White House that belongs to them, and that it is imperialism or bust, it is hegemony or bust. And any president who evinces even the slightest move towards a shift in foreign policy and America's role in the world is treated as an enemy of the people. I'm thinking JFK, I'm thinking RFK.
Yes, yes. Well, I'm sure you remember that great movie from the 1960s, 7 Days in May, in which the military, led by the Joint Chiefs of Staff, played by Burt Lancaster, decide to topple the President of the United States because he's embarking on a detente policy with the Soviet Union. But in some ways, we're in a more dangerous situation than the situation depicted in that film, because we now have not just kind of crazy military types who are planning this coup. I mean, you're talking about a vast media, political pundit, policymaker, think tank apparatus.
Yes, George, sorry, hold that thought, sir. We've come right up to the break. You're listening to George Zamouli. This is Hard Facts. We'll be right back.
We have to be very, very careful. What we're talking is not so much democracy, we're talking organised hypocrisy. Hard Facts.
Welcome back to the second half of Hard Facts. I'm sitting down in the company of author and political commentator and journalist George Zamouli. George's most recent book is Bombs for Peace, NATO's Humanitarian War on Yugoslavia. George, sorry, I had to cut you off there. We'd run up to the break. You were saying regarding the movie 7 Days in May. Please continue.
Right, exactly. So I was saying that it's a more dangerous situation because at least in 7 Days in May, this insurrection, these coup plotters were exclusively located within the military. And so they could eventually be taken on and defeated by the duly elected president. Now we have a conspiracy that engulfs the entire kind of liberal political elite, the media, think tank, apparat, or the policymakers, pundits. They all subscribe to this idea that Trump is somehow an illegitimate president, and that any attempt to move towards peace, towards reconciliation with Russia, non-interventionism, must be stopped at all costs. And they would readily be happily to countenance a coup. And in fact, today on television, there were a number of people who appeared on TV and were in fact suggesting that it is time for the military to step in and for some kind of a coup to take place. I mean, this is just absolute insanity that supposedly reputable voices go on television and advocate the overthrow of a democratically elected president. But this is where we have come
to. The mask has been removed, has it not?
Yes,
The mask of democracy has been removed to reveal the snarling beast of liberalism and liberal interventionism, which has now converged with neoconservatism to pose the greatest threat to mankind that we've ever, ever experienced since the Second World War.
Yes, that's exactly right. And so now there really is, we're on the brink of some kind of a serious civil war within the government, because you have this an established elite that wants to topple Trump, and he has a popular base. I mean, he has a popular base that is prepared to rally behind him. I think this has the makings of a very serious, very ugly political confrontation, because as these people, I think, will try to topple him, and you know, you can't just topple a democratically elected leader without provoking an armed response, and I think that may well come in the United States.
Speaking of Trump's base, George, is it holding up? I mean, what kind of support does he have at this stage?
I think he does. I mean, that's the interesting thing, that his policy towards Russia is actually very popular among his base. I mean, when he gave his speech, I think last week, and when he said that Putin is fine, which left the pundits, you know, jabbering like idiots, his audience was ecstatic. They were really delighted when he said that about Putin. So his foreign policy is popular, and I think, you know, therefore, you know, there's a real disjunction here between what the public wants, which is quite sensibly peace, and the strange, horrific kind of political class that thrives on war, that has no other, is a parasitical class, because the only way they can go on existing and collecting their ridiculous salaries is by whipping up war further.
I had one of these morons, and that's the only word to describe him, a journalist, I won't mention his name, who I engaged with on Twitter in the wake of Helsinki and the flurry of invective that was issued from neocons and their media and media bag carriers and within the commentariat, telling me, I mentioned US and Western foreign policy, the disasters that we all know, the catalogue of disasters going back many, many years, and he described those as mistakes. This is what we're dealing with. You know, Iraq in 2003, the sanctions on Iraq before that, 13 years during which 2 million people died, including 500,000 children, to which Madeleine Albright infamously averred that it was a price worth paying. The disaster of Libya, never mind the breakup of Yugoslavia, going right back to the 50s, you know, Iran in 1953, Guatemala, 54, Indonesia, 1965, Vietnam, on and on and on, Syria, Afghanistan in the 1980s, mistakes. I mean, what is it going to take to produce some kind of shift in consciousness with these people? Is the ideology they breathe like oxygen, is it really that strong?
I think it is. You raise a very good point, that the pundits who appear on TV to denounce Trump as a traitor and evil are often people who served in the Bush administration. And they quite shamelessly appear, pontificate, they're treated with great respect, they're all picking up enormous salaries, whether as pundits on TV or as denizens of these overpaid think tanks. And they pontificate about world affairs, and without giving a thought to the catastrophe that they wrought on Iraq. And as you said, I mean, if you ask them, well, what about Iraq? Well, we made a few mistakes there. You know, we didn't handle that well. We should have handled that differently. But hey, well, that was last time. You know, we're on to the next country now. Let's bomb Iran. Let's bomb Syria. So this is this bizarre mentality. I don't think anything can change these people short of a war that ends catastrophically for the United States. Now, obviously, that's something undesirable. Nobody wants a war that, you know, ends in disaster, as all wars do. But nothing short of that will cause a change in American behavior. I mean, the defeat in Vietnam caused a short change in U.S. foreign policy, very brief.
The Vietnam syndrome, yeah.
Exactly, from 75 through to about 1978. By 78, America was already back on
track.
As I said,
these are people who have forgotten nothing and learned nothing, per the words of the famous French statesman Talleyrand. As you say, for them, the world is nothing more than a giant chessboard, and non-Western countries are mere pieces upon that chessboard that are available to be moved around or changed or removed at their whim. Because this is rooted in racism, let's be honest. Imperialism and racism are two sides of the same coin. We all know about Trump's racism, but these hypocrites are equally racist. They don't give a damn about children in Iraq. They don't give a damn about children in Afghanistan or Libya or Syria or anywhere where this blood-soaked juggernaut has trod foot over the last decades and more. And so the hypocrisy is utterly, utterly nauseating. I mean, they're so intoxicated with the supposed verities of Western hegemony that it's not blood that flows through their veins. It is hypocrisy that flows through their veins, George.
Yes, exactly. And so when you listen to them and they're talking about American values and that we really care about democracy and we really care about the rule of law and we just can't tolerate Putin because our values are just so much more elevated than his. And then, you know, you just, you know, if you list these things, oh, so your values now, who was it who invaded Iraq? Was it Russia? No. Who was it who bombed Libya? Was it Russia? No. Who was it who destroyed Yugoslavia? Was it Russia? No. And on and on. And yet somehow, well, our values are just so much
Ask Geronimo about American values, George. Just ask Nat Turner about American values or Frederick Douglass. Just ask the Haymarket martyrs about American values. I mean, it's quite astonishing the lack of historical understanding of what America really is, as opposed to the myth. And those myths are so deeply entrenched in the American psyche that it is literally an insatiable beast. And one of the key fronts on which this beast needs to be tackled is the ideological front, isn't it?
Yes, exactly so. But, you know, it's very hard to do because the media is now so powerful and it's concentrated in so few hands that there really is just almost no voices that can appear in the mainstream media. I mean, there are plenty of voices, you know, Sputnik, RT, and so on, but they will not appear on in the mainstream. And so they're basically, these people are just talking among themselves. They're talking about Ukraine, Crimea, Putin. Not one person, not one scholar, academic is invited on who might say, well, you know, what happened in Crimea really wasn't Russian invasion. What happened in Ukraine really wasn't a Russian invasion. You know, what happened in Syria wasn't Assad woke up one morning and decided to kill a whole lot of people. But nobody who might even raise any questions like this would get onto the mainstream media. And so people do, by and large, get one side of the story. And that's why it is very hard to break that ideology.
Well, let's talk about Ukraine, George, because you mentioned it usefully, because it's connected to this subject. Since the collapse of the Soviet Union, fascism has made a comeback in Eastern Europe, in these former Eastern Bloc countries. There's no other way to put it. In Poland earlier this year, the government passed a law making it illegal for anyone to cite Polish complicity in the Holocaust, which is a historical fact. Not all Poles, there was Polish resistance to the Holocaust, but there was complicity. That is now illegal to cite in Poland. In Ukraine, in Western Ukraine, a main component of the country's national official militia, the Azov Battalion, its volunteers bear SS insignia on their tunics. I kid you not, SS insignia. The attacks on Ukraine's Roma minority community that are being carried out with impunity. In Estonia, in Latvia, every year, commemorations are held to honour honour the participation of Latvian and Estonian volunteers within the SS during the Second World War. And yet Russia's the enemy? And what the West has done, the West has facilitated this recrudescence of fascism and fascist ideas and a distortion of the history of fascism and the role it played in the 1940s and the 1930s beforehand. And NATO allows these Eastern Bloc countries to exercise their historical grievances against Russia today. And we are being pushed into confrontation with Russia in light of these historical grievances, as a consequence of these historical grievances. So we are, to all intents, being held hostage to those historical grievances on the part of societies in which fascism is making a comeback.
That's exactly right. And that's why NATO is really the biggest menace to peace in our time. Because as NATO continues to expand and grabs up all these countries who have, as you say, all these grievances against Russia, it means NATO is getting more and more sucked into an almost certain confrontation and armed conflict with Russia. Because Article 5 says that, you know, an attack on one is an attack on all. And so NATO goes into operation.
Sorry, we're coming to the end of the show, George, but just quickly, as Richard Sakwa, a UK-Russia expert of standing, has written about NATO, NATO now exists to deal with the crises that it itself creates by virtue of that existence. And so NATO is not a shield protecting democracy. It is a sword wielded in the projection of imperial power. It's something that you identify and you lay out eloquently and forcefully in your book, which I encourage everyone listening to this show to obtain a copy of. Bombs for Peace, NATO's Humanitarian War on Yugoslavia by George Zamuli. You've been listening to George Zamuli. I'm John White. Until next time, remember, the only facts worth taking seriously are hard facts.